Mr. Director, sorry for the breaking of your presentation, but I want us to stay out of trouble.
No problem, no problem. And I might just want to offer that the joint enforcement agreement that is now a law that it's in statute that we cannot seek a joint enforcement agreement. So that any change in that would have to be a statute change. I just want to remind any commissioners of that.
Now, I know the old one said the director could not do it, but the secretary or the governor could do it. Has that been changed too?
You know, I'd have to read back through that.
Yeah. If it's something that's been changed this year, maybe so. But yeah, the old agreement said that a JEA cannot be entered in by the director, but it did not preclude the Secretary of Governor from doing
so. Okay. So continuing on, we held a multi-state meeting on Southern Flounder. It was actually a multi-state of WebEx because we couldn't all get together at the same time. So as we've discussed in previous meetings, and as you'll hear tomorrow with Mike and Ann's excellent presentation, Southern Flounder is a regional stock occurring in the coastal waters of North Carolina through the east coast of Florida. And at your February meeting, I had informed you that Secretary Regan had asked me to reach out to these southeastern states to explore the opportunity of managing this stock on a regional basis, given that fishery management decisions are based on a stock assessment that's done on this regional area. We held a meeting or a WebEx on April 1st. We had about 17 in attendance, including the directors of Georgia and South Carolina, fishery chiefs, biologists, and myself, but all states were represented. In brief, the states agreed to form a work group to continue discussion after this meeting because Mike's group had been a little busy. And the other state directors and I followed up in Arlington to have, just some general discussion on it. But the basic work group will be formed and convene their first meeting probably sometime this summer. While there was a concern from other states, and I think there's definitely a concern from the other states looking at the stock assessment results, there's obvious caution from those states that were trying to implement even small measures in their respective states in the short term, due primarily to opposition from the recreational community. And there's really not a lot of commercial interest in the other states. I think, in my opinion, we can eventually come to terms for regional management, but it's probably going to take several years, and which is why we're moving ahead. It's also important to note that states like South Carolina implement management changes through, they have to go to the legislature and pass a law. They don't have proclamation authority except on very narrow things. There was also consensus amongst the group that they would rather the stock be managed regionally through four states instead of bringing it to the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, at least to start, due to the wide range of management that has to be approved. All the states have to approve final management actions there. So I just wanted to kind of brief you on some of the current measures that these states have. South Carolina really does not have much commercial fishery at all. What little they have is, I think, mostly out of their trawl fishery. They have a 15-inch size limit and a 10-fish bag limit, and they just lowered that bag limit. It used to be 20. Their gig fishery, they reported, which is a recreational gig fishery, is significant, but they, like us, really don't have a good number on that, and so it's not really quantified. they're recreationally dominated, and they reported discards are a growing issue with that current 15-inch size limit, and we're seeing the same thing. Georgia and Florida both have 12-inch size limits. Georgia has a 15-inch bag limit. Florida has a 10-inch bag limit. Florida does have some commercial harvest. Their fishery is less characterized on the Atlantic coast than it is in the Gulf. Of course, North Carolina, our regulation is 15-inch four fish bag limit for the recreational side, and the commercial side, 15-inch no harvest limit, gillnet 6-inch mesh with a December closure. And then there's some other things that came out of the last supplement prior to it being halted with the settlement agreement. Of course, our issue is discards in the recreational fishery as well, and we also have the no harvest limit on the commercial side. Other sort of anecdotal things is Florida reported with even with a 12-inch size limit, they are seeing fewer keeper flounder, which is troubling because their size limit is only 12 inches. South Carolina mentioned that the Coastal Conservation Association of South Carolina has voiced some concern over the stock as well, but their recent bag limit reduction from 20 to 10 was very controversial and hard won, so I think they're still smarting from that. And it's also important to note that all states reported that even though they have bag limits of 10 or 15 fish, that most hook and line anglers don't fill them. As a matter of fact, South Carolina reports less than two fish on average for their recreational hook and line. And it was thought that a lot of the bag limit opposition to reduce it was because of the gig fishery. So North Carolina is also, just to remind the commission, North Carolina is also the southernmost state that must comply with the provisions of the ASMFC summer flounder management. However, one set of management measures applied coastwide did not provide equitable access to recreational anglers due to the significant geographic differences in abundance and size composition for summer flounder. And because of this, states are allowed to use state-specific conservation equivalency management, which also affects the size and creel limit for southern flounder. And because all recreational flounder in North Carolina waters are managed under sort of the same regulations, changes such as reduction in size limits would require us to go back to the ASMFC and seek that different conservation equivalency. So I think that's very doable. It's just I wanted to point that out. So that's all I had on southern flounder. Questions?
Okay, so I recall you only mentioning one state, maybe Florida, that had discards on the nets. Is that correct? Did South Carolina and Georgia have a comment?
No, I think all the states are reporting concerns. Well, the state that reported concerns with discards was South Carolina, and that was over recreational discards because they went to a 15-inch size limit.
Yeah, but I thought you mentioned the gill nets in the Florida. Did they not have? You didn't?
Okay. No. I did mention it. South Carolina has some. They have some flounder, I believe. And Mike can clear me up if I'm wrong, but I believe they have some flounder catch in their shrimp trawl fishery.
Okay. All right.
I'm sure we'll talk about this tomorrow, but I have the question of, you know, with all these states with different management techniques and different programs, and they're all seeing declines, and we're about to put forth our own management technique without mirroring from all these other, or mirroring all these other states mirroring our same management, how do we expect to see any positive change, or can we expect to?
I mean, we could talk about this for a long time. I think it's better to wait till tomorrow when we introduce that subject. And I want to point out that tomorrow, you know, we will take as much time as possible to answer as many any questions you guys have. We want everybody to be comfortable in their knowledge of this subject, what we know, what we don't know, and we'll be very upfront about that as well. So, but I think tomorrow would be the better time for that. So, moving on, the new requirements for shrimp trawls will go into effect July 1 for areas of Pamlico Sound and portions of the Pamlico and Neuse Rivers. These requirements were approved by this commission at your May 2018 business meeting as part of Amendment 1 to the North Carolina Shrimp Fishery Management Plan. This was after a collaborative study between the Division, NOAA Fisheries, Sea Grant, and the commercial shrimp trawl industry that identified four devices that achieve at least 40% reduction in bycatch, as was required by the shrimp FMP or the amendment to the FMP. The new gear configurations are required in all shrimp trawls except skimmer trawls used in inside waters where up to 220 feet of combined head rope length is allowed. So that's Pamlico Sound, portions of the two rivers. Gear requirements for the remaining internal coastal waters where up to 90 feet of combined head rope is allowed, and for the Atlantic Ocean out to 3 miles remains unchanged. The new gear configuration requirements for trawl nets include increase the tail bag or tail bag caught in minimum mesh length to 1 3/4 inches, specify the use of authorized bycatch reduction devices properly installed and operational in the tail bag, and specify the installation of turtle excluder devices. And we also had a Virgil Potter bycatch reduction device that was also approved. Tri-nets are limited to a maximum of 12-foot head rope length for consistency with federal requirements. And any questions on that? Yeah, is Kevin Brown here, by the way?
Mine's just not. I'm excited about that. Will we get a report back after some period of time when they've used the new stuff just to hear how it's doing? And do we know? I mean, I don't know if it's a detailed report, but just like, hey, here's on the ground what we're seeing, and it seems like it's working. It's
we can report back. Kevin Brown, who's the lead there, is not here at this meeting, but I believe he's been very busy working with the industry to ensure everybody gets these things in place where they're supposed to have them and count the meshes down and that kind of stuff. So
I'm excited to hear.
Okay, great.
Pretty great.
The status of the along with that was a peer review for the bycatch reduction industry work group study. And so it was 3 years, and so the edits and reviews are current. I believe that's very close to going to the publisher, but we're working with Sea Grant and NOAA as co-authors on that, and there's some internal review policies for that. But that peer review process continues on that, and we'll let you know as soon as that that gets submitted. Fishermen, just want to point out that we have a very active tagging program, and to sort of juice it up a little bit, 15 fishermen won $100 each from the division's multi-species tagging program yearly drawing that we had. The tagging program randomly selects tag numbers from more than 860 return tags from 2018, and three tags were selected from each of the five species that are tagged by the program. So we tag striped bass, red drum, spotted sea trout, southern flounder, and cobia throughout the estuarine and ocean waters in North Carolina to study the migration growth, habitat use, and population status. The multi-species tagging program is a a leader in its industry, or a leader in the along the coast. It began in October 2014, and it's funded by the Coastal Recreational Fishing License Grant. And the staff and volunteers, which I'll go into here in a minute, place yellow or red tags on over 15,000 fish a year. So speaking of that program, in April, the division held two tagging workshops in Washington and Wilmington for current and prospective citizen taggers to instruct them on the proper methods of fish tagging. So all prospective taggers are required to attend this one workshop and receive training in fish tagging before they receive a tagging kit and they can start tagging fish. We provide information on the purpose and the expected benefits of the program and highlight results from the previous 5 years of tagging. In the workshops, review the program objectives and results, provided hands-on tagging demonstrations for all new and current taggers. So,
Roughly what's the percentage of return on the tags? You said you got 800 some last year, and I'm sure somewhere over a couple of years, maybe previous, but roughly tagging versus number return, what are we looking at?
I have to defer to staff on that.
That's okay. Just curious.
Mike's going to come up and take a swing at that.
That's a great question, and it's really species specific. So we have anywhere from, say, 3% with striped bass, and we can get upwards of 10 or 11% with southern flounder, spotted sea trout. But we certainly do the best that we can to educate the public about the tagging program, and that certainly helps with that reporting rate.
Sure. Just curious.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
So just to update you on our Hurricane Florence, October 2018, North Carolina General Assembly authorized $1.6 million, and then in November, an additional $10 million to reimburse persons holding a standard commercial fishing license, an RSCUF or a shellfish license, for all or part of the period of September 1, 2018 through November 30th, 2018 for reductions in landings. So landing reductions must be demonstrated from trip ticket data or other verified landing compared with the average landings over a prior comparable period from 2015 to 2017. So we have dispersed to date $3,500,000 in September, $4,199,000 in October, and $3,600,000 in November to that. So it's been a very active program, particularly in the license and statistics section, which is Stephanie McInerney's area, and I really want to commend her and her staff for just yeoman's work, the amount of time and effort that's been put into this, because this was sort of an additional thing that we had added to our plate, and it's taken up a tremendous amount of effort. So I just want to commend them. Great job. So, and they're here if you have any questions on that as well during the meeting. Sort of always sad to report these things. The division closed 2,877 acres. It's approximately 4.5 square miles of shellfish waters due to high fecal coliform bacteria pollution. And every year we reassess and reclassify waters based on the last 30 water samples, which is approximately 5 years of data taken in each of our growing areas. And if the bacteria levels are found to exceed national standards, the waters must close to shellfishing. So we talk with the Shellfish Sanitation Recreational Water Quality section, and they believe the high rainfall in 2014, 15, and 18 contributed to these changes. Most of the larger closure areas are being classified as conditionally approved closed, which means they still may be able to open in like a period of drought if we don't have a lot of input from stormwater. And we'll continue to monitor all these waters. We don't get rid of any of those stations, and hopefully can get some of those reclassified. So, and if anyone needs a list of those, I have that as well.
Have you ever opened it? How often does that happen? Has it happened? Like reopening after it's conditionally closed.
So it's important to note there are kind of two closures. Right. There's a permanent classification, which is prohibited.
Those particularly, the permanent closures, they don't ever come back once. It would take a lot.
Yeah, but most of the time when an area is prohibited, particularly if there's any point sources, it's really not going to come back unless those sources are removed. Because of the amount of time that it really takes to reclassify those waters permanently, we don't really see a lot of areas come out of a downward classification. It happens from time to time. And if you had a five-year period of drought, it might happen. But typically, once you see that downward classification, they don't recover. Now, if we can get them into a conditional management scenario, particularly if it's conditionally approved open, then it's open until you get like a heavy rainfall, and that's what does those temporary closures based on that. If you look at the waters from Cape Lookout to the South Carolina line, most waters are classified as conditional, and they're not a fully approved waters.
So that 2,000 acres, where was that particularly? Was that
most of it was from Carteret County South. Well, most of it was from Carteret County South. We know that, you know, development, impervious surface, runoff, those are the keys. I mean, that's really the trigger. And as we see areas become more developed, we see more and more longer temporary closures until eventually we get a permanent. One of the more significant closures that was, you know, very unpopular, of course, is the Lockwoods Folly closure in Brunswick County. So it's a very productive area.
Can we classify, like when you have that, do you know specifically like these developments, this new stuff contributes to this area significantly? Do we have it that specific? Because I thought I remember a presentation maybe three meetings ago where they talked about, you know, they could look at the individual discharges out of different places and see how negatively that was affecting. Because here, I'm confused because we're trying to open a shellfish aquaculture system in North Carolina to really enhance that. And meanwhile, we're continually closing more stuff. So,
right.
Can we not point the finger to specific places where it's coming from and address it?
So there's a lot of scientific study that has direct correlations between impervious surface and water quality degradation, whether it's fecal coliform or other things. So that's pretty solid. But that's more general. You know, when the more developed the watershed becomes, the more likely it is to be degraded. As far as specific sources, and I've been asked this by the General Assembly before as well, I can't point to a high sample and say that was caused by hogs or people or dogs or cats or whatever. You can do that. There is source tracking available using you know, PCR methods and DNA analysis and that kind of stuff. But you have to. It's real expensive, and you know, we just don't have. We take about 10,000 water samples a year and run them in two labs that are FDA certified. So we don't have the time to really
get down to that level of detail.
But it's possible. I mean,
it is possible, and some of the universities probably have that capability. UNC, IMS, in particular.
So when we got remind me when we saw something about like the water was being dyed a color and tracking how long it took. What?
Yeah. So on wastewater treatment plants, we're required under the national program to determine mandatory closure areas regardless of what the water quality is.
Okay.
Right. So you could have really good water quality outside of a wastewater treatment plant discharge because it's treated, but we have to dye those systems out to look at the dilution in the event that there's a failure or a issue with the plant, right? So on those closures are based on dye studies to look at, you know, if it failed at, you know, primary treatment, secondary treatment, disinfection, whatever part of that plant, then how big would the closure have to be? That's what the dye studies are for.
So how could we be proactive, and if we want to foster shellfish aquaculture in North Carolina, how would we be proactive to address some of these water quality issues now, whether it's through requesting funding or whatever, I think that's a really valuable business that we can, you know, but if we're going to be closing everything because poor water quality, I know that's probably more in water quality's division, but what can we do funding wise, request wise, through the commission to help improve that so that we can open water?
Well, I think certainly, you know, the department right now is fighting very hard to maintain and even sort of increase a lot of the stormwater regulations. And we see stormwater as sort of the conduit, as it were, for fecal coliform, silt, whatever. You know, supporting strong stormwater in the coastal area in particular, because fecal coliform, if you have high fecal coliform, it's not coming from Raleigh. If it's down here, it's local, because it'll die by the time it gets from Raleigh to here. Silt, those kind of things might be an issue coming down the river, but fecal coliform is a local issue primarily. So, yeah, just supporting, strong stormwater measures, riparian buffers, those types of things that a lot of this is addressed in the CHIP. And we can certainly come back and provide sort of, you know, right now we're looking at living shorelines. We look at, you know, we're trying to promote riparian buffers, keeping those good vegetative buffers along the shoreline, keeping development down to a, you know, sensible density. So, yeah, those are all things. And the department, you know, is where all these other agencies are as well, with water resources and coastal management as well. We're trying to schedule a meeting, or the department was trying to schedule a meeting with all the division directors to talk about coastal habitat protection plan issues. And I'm not sure where that's at, but I think that's in the works as well. So. Okay, so moving on, we just put our May edition of the newsletter Insight out, and this publication sort of highlights all of our fishery management commissions. So it highlights the Marine Fisheries Commission, the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, regional councils in the National Marine Fisheries Service Highly Migratory Species Division. So sort of gives a broad brush view with links to more information on sort of how all the different species are managed across the state, including out into the federal waters and even the highly migratory species such as bluefin tuna and those. The division implemented a no gill net corridor along the ocean surf zone. This was in accord with recommendations and some calls we had
with National Marine Fisheries, and they were recommendations provided by the Federal Bottlenose Dolphin Take Reduction Team. This implements a no-gill net corridor along the surf zone out to 100 yards to include large mesh gill nets. We already had a prohibition of small mesh gill nets out in that, so now it is a 100-yard no gill net zone off of the beaches. Our license season has begun for 2019-2020. So far, we see our license sales are a little slower. Fishermen, commercial fishermen, have to July 1 to renew their licenses for the upcoming fishing year. Patricia Smith's group is hard at work on a new recreational fishing digest. That's scheduled to be released in the next few weeks. They're very popular and are distributed to bait and tackle shops, fishing piers, visitor centers, and they're also paid for by the Coastal Recreational Fishing License Grant Funds. We had a lot of division staff participate in the Earth Day cleanup of the Rachel Carson Reserve over in Beaufort. That was in coordination with our colleagues at the Division of Coastal Management and NEARS over there. And so, and then that was the first one. And then we had another one, which was the Coastal Habitat Protection Plan cleanup in the lower Cape Fear River Islands. And so those were very active that staff, and they volunteer to do that, take leave and go do that. Dr. Yan Lee, who is one of our stock assessment scientists, was the lead author on a blue crab paper that was published in the Canadian Journal of Fisheries and Aquatic Sciences. Laura Lee and Jason Rock were co-authors on this paper, so congratulations to those staffers for that publication. And that's a pretty weighty journal, pretty tough to get into that one, from what I understand. Speaking of that, we've also hired a new stock assessment scientist, Tom Tears. So that group is now fully staffed with three. Tom just finished a two-year Division of Marine Fishery Fellowship at the Center for Marine Science and Technology using data-limited methods for stock assessment in Atlantic sheep's head. He's also in his second year of PhD program in fisheries, wildlife, and conservation biology at NC State, focusing on quantitative methods for stock assessment. From 2007-2017, Tom was manager of a trout hatchery in Montebello, Virginia, and he completed his master's of science degree at James Madison University in 2016. From 2014-16. Tom is also a veteran. He's a submariner in the Navy for 6 years, serving as a nuclear engineering laboratory technician. So I'd like to ask Tom to stand up so you all know what he looks like, and congratulations, Tom. We're happy to be fully staffed. So I'd also like you to join me in congratulating Garland Yop, who has accepted the position of captain in the Marine Patrol's Southern District. And many of his staff are here today, but I don't think Garland is here yet. So this is beginning to be a trend for me. Garland began his career with Surf City Police Department in 2001, joined the Marine Patrol in 2003, working in the Holden Beach area. Also has worked in the Hampstead area. He was promoted to sergeant in 2014. Is a joy to work with, a team player, hardworking, and looked up to by his peers because he's about 9 feet tall. So so I'll ask him to stand up and be recognized, but you'll recognize him when he walks in. So we do have to report Adam Stemley, who is our economist, has left the division and taken a job out of state. And so we are now without an economist. We have one. So they work under Stephanie's shop in License and Statistics, so we're working very hard to get that position filled as quickly as possible. rule development for scuffle transfers. Stephanie has been continuing to talk with commissioners and make modifications to the rule development to clarify scuffle license transfers, and I believe you have a memo and some draft language in your notebooks about this, so I'll ask Stephanie to step up and talk to you about this issue.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. So, as Steve mentioned, I'm going to be talking about scuffle transfers, and we've been talking about this a lot. I'm sure you guys are tired of seeing me up here talking about this. But for the last several commission meetings, you know, we have been talking about the transfer rule for standard commercial fishing licenses, and last year the commission stated they wanted to make sure that the transfers that were occurring were defined in statute and that they were not third-party transfers such as those that are occurring through Craigslist. So at the last MFC meeting in February, I presented a version of the rule. That rule is 15A NCAC 030-0108. So I presented a version of that rule that had two different changes to it. One of them was adding grandparents, grandchildren, and legal guardians to the immediate family definition. These members of family are included in the eligibility rule, but were not recognized in the transfer rule. And then the other thing was identifying the certification form that DMF already requires to be filled out by the person receiving the transfer to confirm that they are eligible for that license. This form was not mentioned in the rule previously, and so that was added. So at the last meeting, the commission was fine with those changes, but after the meeting, Commissioner Blanton expressed to me that he wanted to include some language in the rule that allowed business transfers. Some language was presented back in November 2018 that had some language about business transfers, but there was some concern that the language was vague and there were potential for loopholes in enforcement. So what I am presenting today is another revised version of the rule that includes additions for business transfers that allows some flexibility for businesses to transfer their license under specific conditions. So I was hoping to try to meet some of the concerns about the vagueness and the loopholes with the language that was presented today. So if you look at the rule on page 2, there is some highlighted text with two additional definitions for that rule. And then on page 3 is another set of highlighted text, and that is the language we're going to be talking about today. So I know that this is not going to accommodate all of the transfer needs that businesses may have, but it is something, and the prior rule didn't have anything related to business in it. I also talked with all of the commercial members of the commission to try to get their feedback on this language and their business practices, and that is where we are. So the scenarios that are provided for in the rule now allow for an individual, if they want to establish a business, to be able to transfer that license of theirs to their business name. And in this rule, a business includes only corporations and limited liability companies because the assets of those business types are shared and they're separate from the individual's assets. So it does not include sole proprietors or partnerships or anything like that. It's just corporations and LLCs. Each of these business types must be registered with the Secretary of State, and articles of incorporation for corporations and articles of organization for LLCs will be required to be presented to DMF to prove the business is active and registered with the state at the time of transfer. So the second scenario is if a business dissolves. So after that individual transfers it into their name, if it dissolves for any reason, that business may transfer that license or licenses back to the individual owners. And then in this rule, owner means the shareholder of a corporation or a member of an LLC. And this transfer will be contingent upon a notarized statement showing that all of the owners of the business agree to the transfer. And then if needed, the DMF can create a standardized form that can be used for this statement. The third scenario under C is if a business is sold, that business may transfer their license or licenses to the successor business at the time of sale. And the fourth is that if an owner decides to leave a business, so if you have a corporation and there's three people involved and one person just cannot work with the other people or they decide to go off on their own, there is an option for them to transfer any license they originally owned back to themselves as an individual so that they can do what they want with it and they can continue to fish. But it can only be transferred, only a license that they originally brought to the corporation or LLC can be transferred back to them. And again, this transfer is contingent upon a notarized statement showing that all of the owners agree to this transfer. And so pretty much to move forward, I would like to have a vote from the commission today. And there are three options laid out in your memo that tell you kind of where we can go from here. Option one is to include the rule in its current version that you've seen today, which is the attached rule version with the highlighted text included in the MFC's 2019-2020 package of rules for readoption under the periodic review and expiration of existing rules that you guys will vote on in the August 2019 meeting. Option two would be to include the rule that was presented in February, which is pretty much the attached rule minus anything that was highlighted. So if you have issues with this text, you know, there's a version that you could choose to, an option to choose to go back to the original version of the rule that you saw in February. And then the last option would be to continue to talk about this and work on the rule and move it to the MFC's 2020-2021 or 21-22 package of rules under the periodic review. So if you have any questions, I will try to answer them, and then that's what I have.
Okay, we can have a discussion on this. It wasn't indicated on the agenda as being an action item,
okay,
so we really can't vote on it at this meeting, but we can have some discussion and some edification on it if we need it.
Okay, great.
All right. Okay, discussion, comments. Sam.
Yeah. I can speak to this pretty directly because I'm going to go on record to say about 18 years ago, I bought my commercial fishing license off Craigslist.
Same here.
And so I know that this, we're trying to get rid of bad actors, bad scenarios, but a lot of times, you know, when you do that, you actually exclude some of the good things that can come out of this. And I'll also say, I don't believe any other state regulates the sale of license. I mean, I think we talked about this, Stephanie, that any other state regulates any sort of sale of licenses this way. So we're going off on our own on this. And so I guess that's just kind of my own history with it, is I'm very concerned about how this interacts with assignments and the eligibility pool, because I'm wanting to make sure that there's new people can get into these fisheries and that we don't, you know, basically exclude and condense this based on unintended consequences. So that's kind of my main concern when it comes to this.
And we do have a plan to work on the eligibility rule and the assignment rule coming up in year three. We're going to be really tackling that. So I know it's on the agenda today to talk about assignments, but we're only talking about transfers.
Right.
So.
Okay. Go ahead, Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank Stephanie for the time she's put into this. I had a lot of conversation with her multiple times to sort of address this direct transfer, business to business, or whatever, you know, we want to call this. And some of the concerns, you know, Commissioner Lockridge had outlined, you know, we tried to address that with this here. And we spent an extensive amount of time, I think, vetting this language in hopes that, you know, we could get the buy-in from the commission to kind of move forward with it to promote better business practices. You know, if somebody owns a boat that they want to classify under a business name versus, you know, some sort of sole proprietorship, we would like to allow that to happen. And then say they sell their boat, but you know they bought a big shrimp boat, but they just want to go back crab potting, and they want to get their license back, and they want to get rid of the boat, but they want their license back. We tried to make adjustments for them to be able to do that as well. So I think we really tried to nail this down and spent a lot of time talking about this, and I just wanted to make that clear that the amount of time we spent. One question I have, and it's an administrative question, and the chairman indicated we can't vote on it. Where do we move? Where does this go from here? How do we? Because it indicates here that it would go into the package to be voted on in August, but obviously now we are not going to be able to meet that timeline because we can't take a vote today.
Well, we can't, but we can talk about it. We possibly could take it at our special meeting.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, if there's enough consensus without issues that this version of the rule is what you guys are okay with, you don't have to have a vote. You guys can verbally say, this is the one that I want to see come back in August, and we can bring it back because August is set for a vote. This was just a way to outline, clearly kind of what was going on, and there was communication breakdown between me and Nancy about the fact that a vote needed to be on the agenda. So I apologize for that.
Yeah, no problem. Can we just do a consensus saying that we need to move forward with this for consideration in August, or should we actually have a vote, Counselor? If we have a consensus that this is the way we want to go with this, we can vote on it in August, and I'll bring it up at a special meeting. So, go ahead.
First off, I appreciate Commissioner Blanton's time and Sam's time, and I don't know if Doug worked on it, but all of you guys have done a good job. I have a question for Stephanie on the transfer business to S corporations and whatever, and being able to transfer from the corporation back to the back to someone who's coming out of that business or retiring or business is dissolved. In no way will these impact the current situation whereby an out-of-state person without NC residency, the whole thing about having to be a resident to possess a SCFL in the state of North Carolina. So this is not going to change any of that, or if I had a C corporation and had four guys from Florida and two from South Carolina and me, and the guy in Florida wanted to get the license transferred to him, that would not be available. I mean, is that?
It would be available to him at the non-resident fee price for Florida.
Okay. Yes. Thank you. That's the only if we could get clarification on language that they could transfer it to him as an out-of-state license, I think that would be very helpful if it's not an objection to you and Sam and Doug or whomever.
Yeah, and I do think in the transfer rule in other places there is probably already language that
talks
about that.
I just want to be sure this did not supersede that.
Yes. Yeah, it shouldn't mess with any of that.
All right. Yep. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, we were looking to clear up some of the issues that you had addressed in a previous meeting and to try to take away from being able to create a loophole through whatever, and to try to transfer licenses. But we, like I said, we wanted to make sure that we addressed the business climate type issue of corporations and LLCs, pertaining to maybe the larger vessels or how, however people set up their business plan.
Okay. Sorry. Right. Okay. Anybody else have anything they want to say on this?
Last thing. I certainly see no reason not to support this, going forward. I do think at some future meeting we're going to have to, or the commission, whoever they are going to have to address the kind of archaic thing of the eligibility pool. It should be much easier for a young man another Sam coming up to be able to get this with proper timing and everything else without having to go on Craigslist and pay multiples of what it would cost. We already know from DEQ Council that this is a privileged license and not a commodity, and it's a great clarification that we haven't had for, you know, a number of years. So I think somewhere maybe DMF can use some of their legislative time to maybe even have legislators come in and talk to the commission about licensing and basically doing away with the eligibility pool to make it easier for folks that want to get into this to be able to participate.
Okay, I believe we have a go ahead, Cameron.
Mine's not about licensing. That, but I just have a question while she's up here about something else
okay,
that she
well,
handles.
Let's focus on Red first. I think we have a consensus about these changes, so we will bring it up for vote at August meeting.
Okay, great. Sounds great.
Now, Cameron,
super quick, can you explain the new swordfish tagging or license? Or I got an email, and I've had like five people ask me at the state level, there's something we have to pick up from our office now, from a district office.
About swordfish?
Recreationally catching swordfish, and I've had a couple people. Oh, okay. Maybe you don't have that. I thought you might have had that in licensing.
Yeah, we'll get it.
We can get it later.
So Chris is coming up. He's our coastal angling program manager.
It's kind of sort of a license. So, yeah.
So that's a part of the HMS reporting. So it's bluefin tuna and swordfish.
Right.
And so what we do is we send a letter out that says, you know, for the catch card, HMS catch card program, you had to report these species, and you can get them at the locations, the tag and the catch cards. You have to fill them out before you remove them forward.
But it's not different from what I when I get my HMS permit.
It's same thing. It's just we're sending.
Okay.
We send reminder letters out.
I was thinking. Okay, that helps. I thought there was a new state piece that.
Nope.
Okay. Thanks. Right.
I'm glad there isn't, because I was like, oh no. I don't know what, you're
what did you miss?
Great. Safi, thank you very much.
I tell you what, before we continue on with the director's report, why don't we take about a 10-minute break? I think. Okay, let's be getting back to our seats, please.
You coming to pay me?
Okay. No, he's right there. Let him stay there. Okay. Mr. Director, would you resume your presentation, please?
Yes, sir. Thank you, and thank you, Stephanie, for that report. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for that break. I'd like to turn it over to Chris Bat Savage, who's going to update you on what's happening in the ASMFC and the Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council, and there are memos following the license transfer in your book that have detailed summaries. So go ahead, Chris.
Thanks, Steve. Good morning, everyone. As Steve mentioned, there's in your briefing materials, there's the meeting summary from the last ASMFC meeting that was held a couple weeks ago up in Arlington, Virginia, as well as a cover memo highlighting the items of particular importance. I'm going to just work off that that cover memo if you want to follow along. First item of interest was striped bass. The Striped Bass Management Board peer-reviewed results from the 2018 benchmark stock assessment. The board received preliminary results back in February. And the preliminary and peer review results were essentially the same. Stocks overfishing is occurring, and the number of recreational discards make up the majority of the total removals in the stock. The board then accepted the benchmark stock assessment for management use. The board also initiated an addendum to end overfishing for striped bass and reduce the fishing mortality rate to the target level. The technical committee determined that it would take about a 17% reduction in total removals to reach the fishing mortality target in 2020. So the draft addendum will consider the following management options: minimum size limit increases along the Atlantic coast and the Chesapeake Bay. A slot limit that would prohibit the harvest of fish over 40 inches total length. Mandatory use of circle hooks when fishing with bait coastwide. a provision that states could use season closures as a conservation equivalency measure, apply the needed reductions equally to both the commercial and recreational sectors, and apply the needed reductions proportionally based on total removals in 2017, both the commercial and recreational sectors. The draft addendum will be reviewed and considered for public comment at the August board meeting. If it's approved, then public comment period will take and hearings will take place in the late summer, early fall, with the board considering final action in October, with the plan to have management measures from the addendum in place in 2020. Next item of interest was Coastal Sharks. Coastal Sharks Management Board approved new recreational minimum size limits for Mako sharks in state waters. Basically the same ones that match those put in federal waters earlier this year. So the new size limits will be 71 inches straight fork length for male Mako sharks and 83 inches straight fork length for females. Currently, the minimum size limit for Mako sharks in the recreational fishery in state waters is 54 inches. Safe to say, not many Mako sharks are caught in state waters either here or anywhere along the coast. But the consistent size limits would reduce angler confusion and make enforcement a lot easier. During this meeting, the board postponed consideration of requiring circle hooks while targeting sharks until their meeting in October to give the Law Enforcement Committee and the Coastal Sharks Advisory Panel time to provide some feedback on requiring circle hooks for shark fishing. Next item is the business session, and here the ASMFC approved the Summer Flounder Commercial Issues Amendment. And I've talked to the commission multiple times over the last several years about this amendment, but it finally was approved. Back in March, the Mid-Atlantic Council and the ASMFC Summer Flounder, Scup, and Black Sea Bass Management Board took final action, but the amendment required full approval by the full commission at this last meeting. Normally, when it gets to this point, it's a pretty close to, if not a unanimous vote. This was a pretty controversial amendment, as I know most of you are aware. New York and most of the New England states raised concerns at the business session that the commercial reallocation strategy chosen doesn't address a lot of their concerns, namely the shifting distribution of summer flounder in the ocean. So a motion to remand the amendment back to the Summer Flounder, Scup, and Black Sea Bass Board was made so they could develop further reallocation options. However, that motion failed. But kind of as a concession, ASMFC leadership will work with the Mid-Atlantic Council to consider alternate approaches to future allocation decisions, and there'll be some coming up in the not so distant future with species such as black sea bass, bluefish, and frankly, I think summer flounder will come up. Probably closer than where it was last time. I think the allocation measures that have been in place for about 25 years, these allocation measures, I doubt will stay in place that long. Next item of interest is cobia, because wouldn't be an ASMFC meeting without cobia on the agenda, or so it seems. The South Atlantic Board approved Draft Amendment 1 to the cobia FMP for public comment. This amendment was initiated to address cobia management in federal waters now that that the South Atlantic Council has removed cobia from the Coastal Migratory Pelagics FMP. So it'll extend ASMFC measures at the federal waters. But in addition, the draft amendment addresses other things such as goals and objectives, biological reference points, harvest specification processes, recreational and commercial management measures, and establishing de minimis status for the commercial fishery. The public hearings will occur in June and in July. The June meeting in North Carolina will be on the 13th in Manio, There will also be a public hearing webinar on the 18th for those who are unable to attend one of the in-person hearings. And the board is scheduled to take final action on the amendment in August. And the final item of interest is Spot and Croker. The South Atlantic Board considered state-gathered public input on potential management changes for Croker and Spot that would be triggered by the incorporation of updates to the traffic light analyses that are used for these species. And I know we've discussed traffic light analysis to the commission before in terms of blue crab. Same idea for Spot and Croker. They're used to monitor trends in abundance and harvest and guide management decisions either between benchmark stock assessments or in the absence of a stock assessment. The recommended updates to the traffic light analyses, however, would require management action just due to the results of the traffic light analyses. Much of the public input received from the states that reached out to the public recommended either no new management or very minimal management measures. The board discussed this quite a bit at the meeting a couple weeks ago and acknowledged that the revised traffic light analyses are an improvement over the ones currently used for management. And the management measures resulting from the updated analyses should at a minimum hold the fisheries at the current levels to prevent any major expansion of the fisheries as they currently are right now. So as a result, the board initiated the addenda to both the Spot and Croker FMPs to incorporate the revised traffic light analyses and to redefine the management response. No schedule on when that'll go out for public hearing, but I will keep everyone up to date on that as it develops. That concludes my report on ASMFC. Mr. Chairman, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions for Chris? Yes.
Good. Chris, in the discussion on the reallocation on the basically the summer flounder quota, is there any discussion or any material being used by our state on the establishment, the boats that basically established a quota and those that are historical still in it with the same permits that did establish it back when it first got established? Because I know, and most people know, Carolina boats established most of the quota up and down the whole coast by leaving here. And I mean, they were, going to different ports, but they were mostly Carolina boats that did it. And I mean, I know why New York and everybody else trying to grab more fish, but I mean, when we're arguing those points, is that coming up in any of those discussions, Mike or Chris? I mean, because that's the most valid ground basis for holding what we've got.
Yeah, that came up a lot. Through public comment, through discussion at the council and board level, and when I get to the Mid-Atlantic Council report, I go into a little more detail on that as far as the what the allocation strategy was, and maybe can add a little more than what I have in the memo on that. But yeah, that certainly came up a lot, and I think in the end it was considered. As far as the final outcome, it of course didn't satisfy everyone around the table for sure. Reallocation rarely does, but yeah, it was brought up.
Anything else? Okay.
On the Mid-Atlantic,
right?
Okay. In your briefing materials, you'll find information on the last two Mid-Atlantic Council meetings, the one in March and the one in April. I'm going to focus just on the one in the March Council meeting, if that's okay. The there's probably things of higher interest that occurred in March and in April. So just in the interest of time, I'm going to work off the cover memo for the March Council meeting. And as you can see, it's very summer flounder centric, so it's a nice segue from what we just talked about. At this meeting, it was most of it was met. The Summer Flounder Scut and Black Sea Bass Management Board from ASMFC met jointly with the Mid-Atlantic Council. The first item that was discussed was the summer flounder benchmark stock assessment. That was the peer review assessment was presented to the council and board, found that the stock is not overfished and overfishing is not occurring, which is a change from the status from the last time. This assessment incorporated the revised recreational catching and marine recreational information program. These catch estimates were quite a bit higher than what was realized in the past, and it contributed to the increase in the estimated summer flounder biomass over the assessment time series compared to what was found in previous stock assessments. The red flag from the assessment results is the juvenile recruitment of summer flounder continues to be below the time series average. This has been going on for several years now, and even though the stock's not overfished, the spawning stock biomass has been on a declining trend in recent years, and I think it's just something to bear watching. If we don't have any good year classes coming through, we may see a further decline. So that's always have to kind of couch it as, this is good news, but who knows in the future. However, it was accepted for management use. It was pretty data rich assessment. That was followed up by the council and board approving the revised summer flounder catching quota limits for 2019 and new limits for 2020 and 2021 based on the benchmark stock assessment results. The commercial quota, coastwide commercial quota for the next 3 years is 11.53 million pounds, and the annual coastwide recreational harvest limit for the next 3 years is 7.69 million pounds. Regarding the commercial quota for 2019, there was an accountability measure applied to the quota this year due to an overage in 2017. So instead of 11.53 million pound quota, it's going to be 10.98. However, that's going to translate into a state-specific commercial quota for North Carolina this year at 3.01 million pounds, which is a pretty good jump from where we currently are right now. This hasn't been finalized yet. Right now, we're somewhere in the 1.83 million pound range, so it's a pretty good step up. So those were approved. That was followed up by the board and council considering recreational summer flounder management measures, and the council and board continued the use of regional conservation equivalency, allowing the states or regions to provide their own regulations to constrain harvest to the harvest limit. However, despite the higher recreational harvest limit compared to previous years from the new MRF estimates, states are largely required to maintain their 2018 regulations because the revised coastwide recreational harvest estimate in 2018, based on the new MRF estimate, is nearly equal to the new 2019 harvest limit. So it kind of washed itself out. There were a couple of states that submitted conservation equivalency proposals earlier this spring that proposed very minor changes to the regulations, such as a little shift in their season and other things like that. However, the opportunity for additional conservation equivalency proposals in 2019 has passed because ASMFC has already submitted the state regulations to NOAA Fisheries, so they could approve conservation equivalency measures and waive the coastwide management measures in federal waters. I wanted to bring that up today during my report, in case some questions come up later in the meeting over other flounder species. After that, the aforementioned summer flounder commercial issues amendment, which I didn't say earlier, frankly, I was surprised we reached final action on that. I thought this was going to be the never-ending amendment, but it somehow managed to end for now. As the reallocation issue was the most controversial one, and the option selected maintains the status quo state-specific allocations when the annual commercial quota is at or below 9.55 million pounds. that when the coastwide annual commercial quota is greater than 9.55 million pounds, the excess quota beyond that amount is equally distributed to all the states except for Maine, New Hampshire, and Delaware, which would split 1% of the additional quota. This results in a more equal distribution of allocations when the quota is high and considers the historic importance of the commercial summer flounder fishery to the states. So as I mentioned before, you know, the quota is going to be about 11.5 million pounds. So there's going to be roughly 2 million pounds that will get distributed out evenly to the states. And in the briefing materials, there's a nice fact sheet that the Mid-Atlantic Council staff put together to show what that looks like. And this was something, there was quite a bit of discussion around the table on this, and talking to state reps from New Jersey and Virginia and Maryland, you know, the southern end of the range, we kind of felt that this was probably the most reasonable compromise as far as making quota available to the states up in the north. You feel like there's more fish available in their area. However, maintaining the historic fisheries and quotas that were developed on this for this fisheries in the states such as New Jersey and Virginia and North Carolina, it's not an insignificant amount of quota being transferred. If you look at the table, it shows that North Carolina is foregoing about 300,000 pounds of fish. You put that into dollars, you know, conservatively, that's about $1 million. But at the same time, it's, you know, as the quota, the overall quota goes up, North Carolina's goes up too, just not as much. So that was a pretty big hurdle, I think, for the council and board to cross. The other issues that were considered, such as the federal requalification permits and allowing landing flexibility as a frameworkable item, no action was taken on those, so it was basically status quo. The goals and objectives were also changed during the amendment, but that was pretty much the allocation was the big lift. The next item was the council and board set interim catch air quotas for 2020 for black sea bass, scup, and bluefish. They did this to have something in place in 2020. They're going to change probably early part of the year because all three of those species are undergoing operational stock assessment updates later this year. They're going to be incorporating the new recreational harvest estimates. But on the council side of things, they need to have something on the books on January 1st. But it'll be kind of like what we did with summer flounder this year. We'll, you know, probably go back and revise the quotas for these three species based on the assessment results. And then final item of interest is the Mid-Atlantic Council approved management measures for the Chubb Mackerel Amendment to the Council's Atlantic Mackerel, Squid, and Butterfish Fishery Management Plan. This, you know, puts the species in the FMP. It establishes catch limits, permitting requirements, essential fish habitat criteria, things like that. And it applies to chub mackerel that are caught in federal waters, that is 300 to 200 miles offshore from Maine through North Carolina. All right, that concludes my Mid-Atlantic Council report. Mr. Chairman, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Right. Any questions on Mid-Atlantic? Okay, great. Chris, thank you very much for your presentations.
Thank you, Chris. I'll turn over now to Steve Pollan, update you on South Atlantic Council activities.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. So I'll provide an update to the last South Atlantic Council meeting. It was held March 4th through 8th in Jekyll Island, Georgia. Very, very beautiful place.
Beautiful spot.
Yeah. If you look through the agenda, there's not a lot of items, in the memo. There's not a lot of items in the memo that we took final action on, but on the attached meeting summary, it's quite a litany of issues that we discussed at the council. This is one of those meetings where we didn't really take final action on many things, but we kind of touched on just about every issue and every FMP that we have authority over. So At the beginning of the meeting, NOAA Fisheries announced the 2019 American Red Snapper season for the commercial and recreational sectors here in the South Atlantic. The recreational season will be 5 days, starting the weekend of July 12th through 14th, and then the following weekend, July 19th and 20th. This will be the same regulations as in previous years during the limited season of one fish per person, any size. Council is also strongly encouraging recreational anglers to report their catch through the My Fish Count app and also donate carcasses through the various state-run carcass collection programs. The commercial season will start July 8 with 75 pounds gutted trip limit. This is the same as in the past. After NOAA Fisheries made this announcement, we had considerable discussion around the table about developing a way that the council could have a little bit more flexibility in choosing these dates. There were a lot of council members and states that felt like they could better apply the days to the fisheries in their specific regions a lot better than just the prescriptive first weekend after the 4th of July. So the council initiated a regulatory amendment to give us a little bit more of that flexibility. And because it's an abbreviated regulatory amendment, we're hoping to get this wrapped up before the 2020 season. And hopefully it'll allow the states to select what days throughout the year that we can have our recreational American Red Snapper season, and also not begin the commercial season until the recreational season has either started or ended, depending on which each state desires. Steve Murphy with the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries sent a letter to the South Atlantic Council requesting the establishment of special management zones around all of our artificial reefs out in the EEZ. This is 30 artificial reefs outside the 3-mile boundary. The special management zone provision was included in the very first Snapper Grouper Amendment back in, I think, 1983, and with the intent of adding some gear restrictions around these artificial reefs since back in the beginning and even to today, especially here in North Carolina, the intent of these artificial reefs are to act as aggregating areas for fishermen. And there's concern that, you know, exceptional gears, and that's language pulled from the original Snapper Grouper Amendment, exceptional gears can go to these areas and really impact the density of fish in these areas and affect other anglers. So we requested establishment of these SMZs on our 30 artificial reefs with the following gear restrictions. So a prohibition of gear other than handline, rod and reel, and spearfishing gear, and a limit of the possession of snapper grouper species to the recreational bag limits when using spearfishing gear. We will look at this request again in September, because after the request was made during council deliberation, South Carolina also expressed interest in adding some more artificial reefs in offshore their waters to this action. So we agreed to wait to bring this back up until September to give South Carolina time to get their formal request letter in. We also spent a considerable amount of time on discussing allocation reviews among all of our fisheries. The Council Coordinating Committee, which is the committee of all the regional councils, executive directors, chair, and vice chair, year and a half ago, provided a guidance document for the councils to follow when discussing allocation reviews and triggers to trigger allocation review, because there's a lot of fisheries that we have, especially in the South Atlantic, where allocations have not been discussed or really considered since the first FMP. Coastal Migratory Pelagius is a good example. King and Spanish have not been looked at for close to 20 years. And there's been a lot of interest in the public and among fishermen from both sectors about reviewing allocations on a more regular basis. So this policy that the CCC developed provides more of a quantitative basis for the councils to first prioritize what species to do an allocation review on, and then what triggers allocation reviews after the priority schedule is worked through. The Modernizing Fish Act, which was passed at the end of 2018, there was a section in there, I think it was section 102, that required the councils, or specifically the South Atlantic and the Gulf Council, to provide a report to the Comptroller General on allocation reviews, and it actually set a later deadline than the CCC had set for the council. So now we're working under that deadline and working more to fulfill this report requirement to the comptroller. But this is something we're actively discussing, and as you can imagine, anytime you discuss allocations, it's not a very simple discussion, and I doubt we will ever have a consensus vote on any of those issues. So moving on past that, miscellaneous actions. We took final action on Regulatory Amendment 22 to the Snapper Grouper Fishery Management Plan, and this amendment just modifies the types of allowable sea turtle release gears that snapper grouper fishermen must have on board, and also allows them to carry a digital copy of the released turtle manual, other than a hard binder. I think it's at least a ream, probably 300 pages. So now this action lets them, you know, save it on their cell phone or device on board. And this was a response from fishermen complaining about all the added gear that they have to carry on board. We also received a report from ASA, CCA, and Yamaha Marine Group on the recreational scoping workshops that they held back in January. The council received this information and requested that the Snapper Grouper Committee or Snapper Grouper Advisory Panel review this information, and the council assured ASA, CCA, and Yamaha Marine Group that we will consider these when working on the Snapper Grouper Management Plan in the future. The regulations that are the recommendations, that came out from these workshops include consider harvest tags for deep water species, so species like blue line tilefish, snowy grouper especially, since it's such a low ACL, and it's a ACL managed by numbers for the recreational sector. It's probably a good candidate for something like a harvest tag, so very similar to, deer and turkeys. You get a tag, you go fill your tag. Also, the development of a state-based permit or angler registry. This is something that recreational anglers have become aware of very recently, given the new catch estimates coming out of MRIP and the issues that the councils have when we are required to use estimates from MRIP that have such high uncertainty, but because of the constraints that we're managing under Magnuson Stevens, we're required to have accountability measures and implement those accountability measures based off of those estimates, sometimes irregardless of the uncertainty associated with them. So this is a way to get a better count of the number of anglers that are participating in the recreational fishery in the South Atlantic, and hopefully put those estimates into a little better context. Also, continued development of descending device requirements. This is something that the council will be reviewing at our upcoming meeting in June. Regulatory Amendment 29 to the Snapper Grouper Plan. Its working title is Best Practices for the Snapper Grouper Fishery, and it looks at requiring descending devices and or venting tools, adjusting the circle hook requirements for the Snapper Grouper Fishery. And this is something that most of the participants in the workshop were in favor of, and were in favor of seeing the council take more action on. And moving on from that, like I said, this meeting, we didn't take a lot of final action, but we discussed a lot of different items, so I'll just move through the meeting report very briefly. We received a white paper and a presentation on the changes in spearfishing effort and snapper grouper commercial fishery. This was a request that actually came out of North Carolina anglers, especially in the southern part of the state. Commercial spear fishermen and recreational hook and line anglers were growing concerned about the what they perceived the large increase in spearfishing effort down there, and then the biological concerns that some anglers had as far as changing sex ratios and the broader reproductive effects that could occur to a lot of these reef species. A lot of these reef species are hermaphroditic and go through sex changes and have a hierarchy, so you know, if too many large individuals are taken off reefs, it could there's a potential there it could affect reproductive success of those fish. The council reviewed the white paper and suggested that the snapper grouper committee also review this white paper to provide us a little bit more feedback. There was a notable increase in spearfish landings and spearfishing effort in North Carolina, and it seemed to coincide with a decrease of that effort in Florida. So anecdotally, it seemed to support what we were hearing from anglers, but the council has not discussed any potential management measures or even if this is something that we feel like needs management at this time. We're really waiting to receive the report from the snapper grouper AP at the next meeting. We also discussed recreational accountability measures amendment, and this is an amendment that looks at adjusting how we define accountability measures for our recreational fisheries. And simply, an accountability measure, it's something that's laid out in Magnuson-Stevens. It's a statutory requirement that any fishery that we manage have accountability measures that are triggered when ACL is exceeded or ABC is exceeded. And basically, the intent of accountability measures are, if they're triggered, it reduces harvest either in that year or subsequent years to ensure that landings do not exceed the overfishing limit. But as I mentioned earlier, the issues surrounding uncertainty in recreational catch estimates have caused a lot of consternation among the recreational community in the past, because I think cobia is a prime example where, you know, landing shot through the roof, the uncertainty was high, but because the accountability measures was triggered, the federal government or the NOAA fisheries had to institute those accountability measures. So what this amendment is trying to do is trying to find a way to better account for that uncertainty, kind of, you know, more or less, you know, soften the blow, per se, but this is something that we're actively discussing. During the Dolphin Wahoo Committee, we received a report from council staff on a request that the council made in December to consider bullet and frigate mackerel as ecosystem component species in our Dolphin Wahoo FMP. And this was from a request from the Mid-Atlantic Council. They just finished up their forage fish amendment, and NOAA fisheries declined to include bullet and frigate mackerel in that final rule, citing that Mid-Atlantic Council did not have management jurisdiction over a fishery that they demonstrated relied on bullet and frigate mackerel. So they asked the South Atlantic Council to consider it under Dolphin Wahoo, since we manage Dolphin Wahoo from the Keys to New York. We decided to send this out for public scoping. Those scoping webinars were held last week, and the public comment period is still open. And the last I checked, I think we're approaching 100 written comments and at least 15 or 20 verbal comments to the webinar. And this is something that we're taking up at the June meeting. We also discussed Amendment 10 to the Dolphin Wahoo Plan, and this is kind of a kitchen sink amendment. We hadn't really messed with the Dolphin Plan through a full amendment in a while, so it seems like a lot of issues are just getting thrown at us in this one. And they run the gamut from considering an adjustment to the vessel limit for dolphin, all the way to looking at allowable big gears in the commercial fishery and bag limit sales for charter boats. We did decide at this last meeting to remove any actions as far as redefining allowable biological catch or our allowable catch limits for dolphin wahoo, citing the new MRIF estimates and the fact that our SSC, who is tasked with providing us recommendations on ACL or ABCs, that they felt that they weren't comfortable providing those ABC recommendations yet until they had a little bit more time to really figure out the new MRIF estimates. So we decided to go ahead and remove those actions so it wouldn't hold up the progression of the amendment. During the Habitat and Ecosystem Committee, we hosted representatives from the New England Mid-Atlantic Councils as well as the ASMFC to discuss issues with species expanding their range northward. We discussed, this is really our first big joint meeting, and it was just more of a brainstorming and strategy meeting, just figuring out what kind of information we need to consider, what options are on the table or not on the table, and really focused on the governance issues of, all right, if South Atlantic Council species are moving in mid-Atlantic waters, you know, who's responsible for them? Do we want joint plans? Do we just want to extend management boundaries? And this is still a very active topic of discussion, and we decided to continue these meetings in person, and we will have these meetings, and it'll rotate around through the different councils for at least the next year while we try to figure this thing out. And with that, unless you have any questions, that's my report.
Big report, Steve.
Yeah.
Mike?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see the last item on the report here is the macro item. And from a commercial standpoint, I've been hearing some stuff, you know, kind of in the background about trip limits, this and that. We've had the last year, I think the season closed a little earlier than what it would normally close. I think participation in the mackerel fishery in North Carolina is sort of, you know, becoming more commercial-wise. As we're changing management strategies on the inside waters, I think it's pushing people more toward that fishery. You know, this just conversation I'm hearing in the background, and I just wondered if you could go through what, you know, the South Atlantic's talking about right now for commercial Spanish and king mackerel, and then I'll get with you further down the road here to talk more specifically, but I'd just like to hear what's kind of going on.
Yeah, absolutely. So mackerel, king and Spanish mackerel is one of our more complicated management plans that we have because we manage it joint with the Gulf Council as well as ASMFC. In North Carolina specifically, there has been a Spanish mackerel commercial closure the last 2 years around the first week of November, which historically that fishery usually doesn't close until, you know, after Thanksgiving or some years to Christmas. And we've received a lot of public feedback, a lot of concern with that closure. A lot of guys feel like it's closing too soon, especially the guys that fish in the ocean during the end of the year. They're saying that landings are increasing in Pamlico Sound, and that's causing the ACL to be called up a lot sooner. The mackerel advisory panel did discuss this issue a few weeks ago during their AP webinar, and there was a lot of discussion around considering limited entry or gillnet endorsement for the commercial mackerel fishery. There was not a lot of interest as far as allocating more recreational ACL over to the commercial sector, but as I said earlier, mackerel is one of the top species that we're prioritizing when we get to the point of looking at allocations and reviewing allocations across our fisheries, because this is probably the one that's hasn't been addressed the longest. So mackerel, North Carolina is in the northern zone, and then there's a southern zone that's at the from the North Carolina, South Carolina line south. And Florida is the big player in that fishery, both commercially and recreationally. And there's a lot of interesting things that go on in Florida, and they've been very vocal as far as seasonally adjusting vessel limits for king mackerel to account for things like Lent and tourist season and that kind of stuff. And in the past, that seems to be the topic that has consumed the council when it comes to mackerel and coastal migratory pelagics, and especially once we got rid of cobia. So management in the northern zone has kind of, you know, been put on the back burner, but it's back at the front burner now because of these early closures. One recommendation that did come out of the AP was to consider a visioning process for the mackerel fishery, very similar to what the council did for the snapper grouper fishery 4 or 5 years ago, where it was about a year-long process of port meetings where we council reached out to commercial fishermen, recreational fishermen, received a ton of feedback on how the fishermen would like to see their fishery managed. And that's really, especially for the snapper grouper fishery, that's what we've been basing a lot of our actions on the last 3 or 4 years. It's off of that feedback. And AP members were very interested in maybe doing that for mackerel, and that is certainly going to be a topic of discussion at the next council meeting, and it's certainly something that I feel like that I'm going to request if another council member does not, because I've also received that feedback from a lot of our anglers here in North Carolina that mackerel fish and snapper grouper fish, especially in the commercial sector, that say, you know, they feel like, you know, that really worked, because a lot of the commercial measures we've implemented for snapper grouper were really born out of the two sectors and desires that, you know, they felt, you know, to get, you know, a little bit more consistency in management, not so much, you know, knee-jerk management of those species. So it's certainly something that I think would be very favorable to the mackerel fishery as well.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Steve. I've talked to you more, hopefully find some time between here and now to just talk more specifically about some of the issues I've heard myself.
I look forward to that. And I mean, anytime you or any of the commissioners have a issue or concern.
Yeah, it's just a growing concern, because like I said, you know, as we change strategies, the way we manage inside, you know, these fish, you know, more available commercially, you know, opportunities are still available to, you know, to use this fishery. And I'd like to make sure people aren't necessarily closed out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are, you know, like I said, management strategies are changing.
Yeah.
It's evident on inside waters. And so, you know, I don't want to see, you know, this go to a closed fishery like quite a few permits are.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, that's my initial concern, is that there's still access going to be available, even if we have to adjust trip limits to make the season kind of go along like it traditionally or historically did.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, yeah, I'd really like to talk to you sometime.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, okay. Thanks. All
right. Thank you, Mike. Cameron, you got something?
Just, you can pass it on for us. This My Fish Count app is very difficult. I don't know what they need to do to streamline it. I've tried to use it and participate.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that would be really helpful just to pass on is if they put all the limits, so that's a separate app.
Yeah.
That talks about everything that's in, and it looks at where you are geographically, pulls up a picture of every fish, and it tells you its limit, and it's awesome. But that's not this app. So it's like you're bouncing back and forth. This could be streamlined and be really useful, but I see why, you know, it says 860 users,
yeah,
and 950 15 trips out of, who knows how many potential users. I mean, it's less than 0.1% probably. But they could streamline it. You got to log in every time. I mean, it's little stuff where I try to use it, and honestly, sometimes I'm like, it's just not worth it. It's a pain in the butt. Where I'd, you know, if they could streamline that a little bit, it'd be awesome.
And
just passing that on.
Yeah, certainly. And we've received similar comments in the past, and I think we've even talked about it at the council table as far as you know, I feel like the council is starting to get very app heavy.
Right.
You know, because we've got the My Fish Count app, there's the Fish Rules app, there's a Scamp Release app, pretty soon the For Hire guys, once the cooling off period for hire reporting comes on, there's going to be another app for that. And it has been mentioned around the table as far as, you know, maybe let's just condense all these apps down into one app.
Yeah.
But all of these are still in the development phase.
Right.
My Fish Count was really something that the council initiated development on, and this was kind of their first step at seeing if, you know, an app could work for recreational reporting if down the line we move to some type of recreational reporting requirement. So certainly, I mean, I'm not going to say it's in the beta phase, maybe, you know, gamma phase.
Right.
You know, it's an iterative thing. So certainly any.
Well, it would be awesome if it worked great. Like, I'm all for it. It's just, it ain't it right now.
I mean, I completely understand, because, you know, personally, I was not born in the right generation. I hate apps too.
The Fish Rules is really simple. I mean, that one's pretty slick, and I find myself pulling that one up because it updates. But this one, it just, the two talk, and then the second thing is just a recommendation when they're talking about descending devices. I don't know how they can look into it. They need to just give some out and get them out there and get people trying them, because they're really simple and they're great. But people aren't going to go spend $50 on something. So, like, a giveaway.
Well, now that you mentioned
that.
So the South Atlantic Council is working with Yamaha Marine Group and Fish Smart. And we've got there's a tutorial on the South Atlantic website right now that goes through the use of descending devices and why they're important. And if you go through the tutorial, and complete everything, they will send you, I think it's a sequelizer.
Oh, man.
And the state also received some sequelizers and some Shelton descending devices, which is basically just an inverted hook, last year prior to the start of American red snapper season. We still have some of those, and we're hoping to get another shipment of those before the red snapper season. But that's something that's really come up among a lot of the public comment for Snapper Grouper Amendment 29, is there needs to be a very good concerted effort for public outreach and public education on this, because we acknowledge that, you know, enforcement's going to be difficult, if not impossible, and we don't have a way to measure compliance with it yet. And really, we feel like the most effective way to get people to using these is educating people and really creating that kind of social shift, or, you know, very similar to what happened with billfish. You know, two or three decades ago, it was nothing to throw whites and sails up on the dock. But now if you do that, you might get run off the dock. And, you know, that was not management or policy that directed that change. That was just an ethical change in angling. So, you know, really, to get people using descending devices, that's probably going to be the most effective tool. But it's hard to do that with policy, you know.
All right. Anything else, Steve? Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. I promise I'm almost done. Real briefly, on May 8th, Secretary Regan, DEQ staff, including DCM's director and myself, met up in Manio for the mayoral roundtable to protect North Carolina's coast. There were about 15, 16 mayors there from Surf City to Duck. And the discussions were on impacts of seismic testing and offshore oil drilling to those coastal communities. And so that's part of the governor's outreach to educate and reach out to stakeholders on that. So, and finally, I'd like to direct your attention to the highly migratory species memo, other informational materials, Red Drum, Southern Fauna Landings, protected resources, the observer program, and rule suspensions. That's all in your book. We're not planning to talk about it, but we do have staff that can answer questions during the meeting if anybody has any questions. And that wraps up my overly long director's report.
Any questions?
Oh, yeah, one more thing. I wanted to mention, you did get a handout Fish Dealer Report and Annual Fisheries Bulletin, which Stephanie Schott puts out. So you also have those as well. So.
Okay, right. Any questions of what Director has reported on at this point? If not, why don't we go ahead and 5 minutes early adjourn for lunch. When we come back, we've got two presentations, and I'm going to get Catherine Bloom to do her rulemaking update today, so we'll have more time tomorrow to devote to the fishery management plans. So we will be back here at 1:30.